the wild Clearwater country. Well, we've got a pretty interesting show lined up for you today. We've got a lot of guests here today. We've got a crowded studio. And we're just going to talk your heads off. We're going to talk about biodiversity. We're going to talk about climate change and its implications. And, of course, like we have been doing for the last several months, we'll feature the peak of the week, which is close to home this week. Most of you folks probably know this peak, hopefully. And maybe you've explored a bit of it. And, of course, the Whopper.
We do have a Whopper of the week.
We do. Well, let's go ahead in and start talking about the peak of the week here. Before we begin, we're going to introduce today's material with one of my favorite songs, and hopefully you get the joke. Here you go.
Hanging in the window in the evening on a Friday night. Little light is shining through the window, lets me know everything's alright. Summer breeze makes me feel fine, blowing through the jasmine in my mind. See the paper laying on the sidewalk, a little music from the house next door. So I walked on up to the doorstep, through the screen and across the floor. Summer breeze makes me feel fine, blowing through the jasmine in my mind. Days of summer, the jasmine's in bloom. July is dressed up and playing her tune. And I come home from a hard day's work, and you're waiting there, our care in the world. See the smile waiting in the kitchen, food cooking on the plates for two. Feel the arms that reach out to hold me in the evening when the day is through. Summer breeze makes me feel fine, blowing through the jasmine in my mind. Summer breeze makes me feel fine, blowing through the jasmine in my mind.
Little Seals and Crofts for you there. No summer breeze here in the Palouse today. It's nice and chilly like it should be. We're going to talk about biodiversity and climate change and some of the implications climate change has on biodiversity. This piece caught my eye, a piece by the AP that came out yesterday. Scientists came out with a report in Geneva, the World Wildlife Fund International, documenting that they have found at least 52 new species of animals and plants on the Southeast Asian island of Borneo. a very hot spot for biodiversity. Some equatorial rainforest found there, and an 85,000 square mile rainforest in the center of the island. And a lot of these species were fish. And I think it's fairly unusual to find this many vertebrate species nowadays. You find a lot of smaller species, fungus, bacteria, invertebrates, etc. But finding this many vertebrate species is a pretty amazing discovery. And to me, it just reaffirms how much we don't know about the living world we inhabit and how rich these areas are. And I think that should compel people to feel a greater responsibility to protect the world we inhabit, since we rely so much on many of these species directly or indirectly for our existence.
Absolutely, Will. It's amazing. Diversity of plants and animals is, you know, fungi, depending on how many kings we want to go into. That's really the issue of the day. E.O. Wilson talks about the importance of maintaining this system of diversity. We're going through a huge mass extinction right now. And unlike past mass extinctions, this one is caused by one species. It's us. Mostly the mass extinctions have been caused by geologic or, in some cases, you know, asteroids, meteorites striking the Earth and changing the conditions on the planet, or geologic processes like volcanic action. In fact, one of the largest extinctions was started by a lot volcanic action. So this is unique, and we can change the course of this great extinction if we act soon enough. And I was interested to see as well all those vertebrate species. It's amazing. I think we don't know what's in the freshwater. My guess is some of these fish are rather small, and they're tiny species that live in many of the areas, because that's typical of a lot of these tropical rainforests, a lot of small species when you look at whether it be the Amazon basin. And it's incredible diversity of small, tiny fish. Some of them, you know, half inch to an inch long.
Yeah, a third of an inch.
Yeah.
Some of the smallest fish in the world. That's exactly right. Gary, and the folks here at the World Wildlife Fund estimate there's about 15 million species on Earth, and see the discovery of 52 species in Borneo as a realistic number, and they don't see that to be slowing down in the near future, as long as scientists... you know, biological inventorying has become very important in the last couple decades, and I think that this kind of work, the work that Michael Fay did... I think it was Michael Fay when he made the transcontinental trek across Central Africa, highlighting a lot of those places, and the work that our scientists do domestically in the United States in these wild places. I think this really should push the agencies to start hiring biologists, which unfortunately hasn't been happening in quite a few years here on the Clearwater. They don't even have a botanist right now.
That's right. And they're without a lot of wildlife biologists. Well, we introduced Brian, our former Muscovite, if we can say that. One of the great basketball players of Moscow High history. Even made the team. Where was it? At Northwestern? Western? What was it?
No, I actually was a... player at a community college in Oregon for a while.
For a while. But didn't you try out for a team that you would have made the team, except you were only there visiting? What was that?
Washington University.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's right.
That's great.
And he actually would have made the team, but you were just visiting. You were doing a semester exchange program or something.
That's right.
Isn't that the story?
That's the story.
All right.
Brian Peterson.
Yes, right. Western Washington. There we go. Brian Peterson. But you were a PhD. You're getting your PhD at the University of Santa Cruz.
That's right.
And you're looking at this big question of global warming and the effects on, and it's very germane to here in the Clearwater Country, public land.
That's right. Yeah, so I'm looking into, starting to look into the issue of how the public agencies are going to react to and respond to climate change and variability on the western public lands in the United States. And unfortunately, to date, they've done essentially nothing. There's some talk of what's going to happen as a result of climate change, and there's some science to show that there already are impacts. But the real question is how the federal agencies are going to react to and deal with and mitigate climate change in the future.
And that is a great question. Ironically, or maybe not surprisingly, the Forest Service in past forest plans, and I'm talking about the ones that are just being revised now or have been recently revised, has refused to look at climate change as a relevant issue. And many of us are saying, no, this is the issue that you need to look at in the next 15 years for the life of this plan, 10 to 15 years, because it's going to drive everything that happens out there in the landscape.
That's right. And not only that, but what we need to start thinking about is beyond just the next forest plan, because a lot of these climate issues are going to be coming about in the next 50 to 7,500 years. And so it doesn't make any sense really to do a management plan for 10 or 15 years when these impacts are going to be happening over a much longer time scale. And so one of the things that we have to start thinking about is long-term management practices and policies that will actually help mitigate and adapt to climate change consequences on the land.
And exactly that. And the Forest Service has, in fact, was doing that in the first round of forest plans. These were actually, even though they were 10 to 15 year plans, they had a planning horizon of 50 to 100 years, 50 year, in fact, mainly 50 year plans. They looked out 50 years in the future. What are things going to be like? And then how do we get there? And then they had plans of actually 10 year increments, and they would revise the plan depending on what was happening. But they're not doing that now. On the second revision, they're not looking out anywhere on these new rounds. They're only saying, well, we want to do, quote, adaptive management, which, you know, it sounds like a good phrase, but basically it means we can do anything we want to everywhere rather than trying to plan for these changes in the, you know, short 10 to 15 year horizon, but the longer, you know, 50, 100 year horizon they should be looking at, rather than seeing how that fits into the management program.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting you bring up adaptive management, because I just did a paper on adaptive management for one of my classes, and you're exactly right. Adaptive management basically is essentially a buzzword and has not been really acted upon. There hasn't been the kind of funding available to really make it work. The monitoring hasn't been there. But in terms of managing the natural resources in the western U.S., in light of climate change, it's going to take an adaptive approach. And so I think adaptive management should be something the Forest Service should utilize, and coming up with what it actually means, what the definition is, what it means on the ground, who should be making the priorities on what to really manage for. Those are some of the questions that in the planning process that the Forest Service and other public agencies should be looking at, but they're just not doing it right now.
So perhaps if they specifically mentioned and talked about the issue of global warming, and because they're going to need some justification for adaptive management, or it's going to be difficult for the public to hold them accountable. That's the catch. They're going to be able to bring old logging proposals out of the closet and throw them on the table and justify them in the name of adaptive management. And so that's the real sticking point there. That's a very good point, Brian, because there's going to have to be a tool in place for them to cope with these changes that we're starting to see already.
That's right. And there, you know, it's interesting that the Northwest Forest Plan, which is now a little bit over 10 years old, set up adaptive management areas specifically where they were supposed to prioritize adaptive management for various goals, one being economic goals in one area, another goal was biodiversity conservation in another area. And so, again, you could use adaptive management if it was done correctly, prioritized, and spelled out as to actually what it was. And again, it's going to make sense when you don't have any idea specifically what climate change will, what kind of impacts climate change will have on conservation, if you know, conservation and on ecological systems on the public lands, it makes sense to have kind of an adaptive approach to deal with those.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to point out that the Forest Service, under the new regulations, which I don't know if they will be upheld by a court of law that's going through right now, on their forest planning regulations. Even though they use the buzzword adaptive management, none of the Forest Plan really is very accountable. And so the Forest Service has the discretion. And in fact, in the past, it had the discretion to amend the Forest Plan very easily. That can be done routinely, very easily. Now they're making it so they don't even have to consult the public. In the past, it was basically they go to the public, do some input, and make the change. Now they just want to be able to do it without consulting the public at all. And these are public lands, and it's the first part of their name, and they need to do that. They already have the mechanisms in place, I think, to deal with these issues. The problem is they don't want that oversight. First of all, and secondly, they really don't want to have to deal with this very tough and complex issue. If they were really using adaptive management as in the way you're describing it, Brian, then it might not be a problem on the ground. It may, in fact, be a positive thing. But instead, they're trying to define it as, you know, anything goes when we say anything goes. And they're not trying to set in place the definitions and the parameters of change and, you know, then how their management would change given those global changes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually just interviewed a district ranger in Central Oregon a couple weeks ago, and she was saying that the Forest Service always does adaptive management. That's just the way they manage. They've always done it that way. There's no difference in the Northwest Forest Plan when it says adaptive management. It's nothing new. And so, again, there's all these questions and uncertainties surrounding the word adaptive management, what it means. But again, if you had a clearly defined definition of what it is, if you set in place that it was, you put in some sort of management, you have monitoring and oversight, you do manipulative experiments, you have controls, you reevaluate, and then you change your management as a result of that later on, and try and adapt to climate change and the implications it's having, that would be adaptive management, and that would make sense in the future to do that.
And that's exactly what it ought to be, and unfortunately, that's exactly what it hasn't been. You bring out, I think, a second key, in fact, maybe the foundation of any kind of adaptive management in global climate change, and that is monitoring.
Yeah.
The Forest Service, unfortunately, has not lived up to its commitment to monitor in these past plans, and that's one place they're falling down, and they're not making that commitment in these new plans, and that, to me, is the worst part of the new forest plans, and in fact the past practices, is the lack of commitment to monitor. If you don't monitor, you're going to have no idea as to what is happening on the ground, and then it just becomes a wild guess and a free-for-all.
Right, and then the next cycle of management plans are not based on the knowledge you've generated
exactly
over the past 15 years or so from the previous management plan. So it's really an important point. And unfortunately, the Forest Service, as you said, doesn't have the kind of biologists and ecologists, hydrologists necessary to deal with this. And then on top of that, there isn't substantial funding for these monitoring, particularly for long-term monitoring and for reviewing the material and the data that's generated from this monitoring to actually implement new management based on those findings.
That's right, and that I think is a problem.
The one thing that I can say that's actually a benefit is with regard to climate change in this issue is while the administration has been just terrible on the issue and it hasn't done anything, the Environmental Protection Agency is now doing a study looking at how climate is impacting right now public lands and looking at how climate will impact them in the future. And also Senators Kerry and McCain have also instructed the General Accounting Office to do a study, which they're starting right now, to look at what climate has already done in terms of impacting ecological systems on public lands in the western U.S. So again, the administration has done nothing, the agencies have done nothing, but the global community and the consensus is that climate change is happening, it's going to have huge impacts, and it's important for the agencies to start looking at it. And, you know, that ball is just starting to roll right now.
One of the interesting things when you say about public lands is I believe there is a study that shows the effect in one specific area. And I don't know how detailed the study is, but I read about it, I believe, in the Journal of Nature. I could be wrong about that. About 3 years ago, Bandelier, I believe it was in or near Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico. And the scientists that were looking at this saw an area change from and they've been looking at this since the 1950s, from a ponderosa pine type, a dry site ponderosa pine type, to pinyon juniper.
Hmm.
That's the site in a certain area. They saw that jump, and they ascribe that to global warming. Now, you know, climate change, you know, has happened in the past, and whether or not this isn't a transition zone that it's happened many times in the past, their study really didn't address it. But
well, there's been a recent study actually that showed that the diebacks in pinyon pines in Colorado, for example, mm-hmm. you know, there was debate on what was actually causing that, and mm-hmm. so people didn't know what it was. They thought mm-hmm. it was maybe just a drought or something, but it actually was linked specifically to climate change. And the way they figured that out was that they had records of droughts in the past from the 50s and earlier mm-hmm. where the drought was actually longer, more extreme in duration, but they found that now the temperatures in the winter are actually what's causing the diebacks from climate change. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, so there are specific examples of climate change having a dramatic impacts already.
Well, we're seeing studies in the isolated mountain ranges, for example, small rodents in particular, their ranges are increasing. What they're doing is they're recreating the studies done by the early naturalists back in the late 1800s in these places. Mm. And those naturalists were very detailed in the notes they took. And so they can go out and recreate them. They're basically doing presence-absence studies of certain species. And they're finding species are increasing their range and elevation. And some species they're afraid may wink out in certain mountain ranges. Pikas, again, yeah. high elevation creatures, some of these isolated mountain ranges which are found, they're going to disappear. They're seeing those changes, the belt, the pinyon juniper, of course we call it pinyon juniper, but it's generally more pinyon on the upper end and juniper on the lower end is sort of moving up in elevation. You're seeing, you are seeing pinyon pine die out in some of these lower elevations. Again, it's that factor, that wintertime temperature, so crucial. And we're also seeing that same equation with pine beetles, which are a natural part of the forest, but they're increasing their range, it seems to be, further north, and the effects of infestations tend to be more severe than they in the past up in British Columbia, for example, where they're going through a very large infestation. We're also seeing that with the spruce budworm, I believe, although it might be a spruce bark beetle, I'm not sure which, up in the Kenai in Alaska.
Hmm. And this even has effects on migration patterns of species. Flowering plants are flowering much sooner than even the recent past. And for a long time, ornithologists thought that the major dictator of migration for songbirds was amount of sunlight, which wouldn't be affected by changing in temperatures. But they found that many songbirds are returning far sooner than they used to on their breeding grounds and leaving sooner in the fall. So some of those assumptions and from decades ago are being proven false by climate change.
That's right. And I just read a study recently that was showing the evolutionary changes that are already happening genetically in certain species as a result of climate change because of these differences in when flowers are flowering. So pollinators, for example, are being acted on genetically. Basically, evolutionary processes are already having impact genetically on all kinds of species. And, of course, the issue with adaptation, and some species are able to move. They can travel, whether it's pollinators, whether it's seeds or vertebrates. The issue is that not all species can move. And so one example of what could be a really critical issue relatively soon is the giant sequoia trees in California. They've been heavily influenced by logging in the past. We already know that climate has had a huge impact on them throughout history and their range. What's happening now, though, is if temperature increases, the giant sequoias have nowhere to go, basically. They can't go any higher in elevation because the soil type changes where they're at. And so they will not be supported at higher elevations. So just a minor change in climate and temperatures could have a dramatic and terrible effect on giant sequoia trees.
Hmm. Wow.
So again, this whole issue of biodiversity and climate change, it's a really critical issue and one that unfortunately the public land managers have not taken seriously enough and have not done anything proactively enough yet to start to think about how they're going to adapt and mitigate climate change impacts?
Biodiversity. There are over 900,000 species of insects that have been described to date, and that's 80% of the world's species. And just to give you a glimpse into how much we really understand about the natural world, scientists out there doing those studies estimate there are somewhere between 2 and 30 million more undescribed species of insects. So we really still have just a fraction of the knowledge and information about our planet. A lot of folks think that we've discovered it all except for the depths of the sea and outer space, but we have so much more to discover just here in our backyard. And as Brian keeps mentioning, here in the West, in our public lands, we have a great opportunity to explore some of these still intact, healthy ecosystems, to describe these creatures so that we better understand them, and also so we can keep their ecosystem and habitats intact.
Yeah, and I think one of the main issues that public land managers need to start thinking about is the role of protected areas in biodiversity conservation. We already have some wilderness areas, some national wildlife refuges, but they aren't sufficient enough. And the problem is that these species are going to be reacting to climate change and shifting. The habitat may shift, species may shift, but the protected areas are locked in place. And so, again, this management approach needs to be proactive. And one of the things I think is something that land managers need to start thinking about is actually co-management. So the Forest Service does management plans, but what they should be doing is doing joint management plans with other federal land agencies and working collaboratively with the states and other private landholders to start putting together plans and management approaches that are broader in scope so that these species aren't reliant on just these locked-in, static, protected areas, but that it's more of a dynamic area where you have connectivity and joint management so that the activities of the Forest Service aren't inadvertently impacting other species on other land designations, for example. It's something that the states and the federal agencies have not done in the past, but climate change, I think, is going to make management for conservation of biodiversity totally different in the future.
One of the visionary pieces of legislation, the Rockies Prosperity Act, Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, as I think as it will be known and was known, that's one of the main reasons for looking at an ecosystem bill is because of climate change. And in fact, there's been a lot of discussion recently among different activists and organizations about this importance. I do know that Bill Newmark, a scientist, has remarked in the past that that's the reason he thinks that it's a good bill, because what it does is the way it's set up, it will be able to deal with and address climate change through the concept of corridors. And what it asks the Secretary of Agriculture, because it's mainly up here in the Northern Rockies, we have national forests, there are some BLM areas that are affected as well, but asks the affected secretaries to cooperate with state and local entities on these, what consider these corridors for connectivity, in finding ways to retain the diversity of life when we see these changes happening as a result of global warming.
Yeah, it's kind of an acknowledgement of knowing that, you know, if and when we start curtailing emissions, we're going to see some changes before then and even after then, and perhaps we can mitigate by providing the space for these species to do some adapting on their own. Whether or not they wink out, we probably won't have a lot of control over. But if they have the space and protection, perhaps they'll pull through.
Well, we already know that carbon dioxide has a lifespan of about 100 years in the atmosphere, and so we already have elevated levels. And so climate change is just beginning, and it's not going to end anytime soon, even if we cut all emissions right now. There's still going to be climate change in the future. So this is a problem that we have to get our heads around. And this idea of corridors is very interesting. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is the notion of managing the matrix, not just specific corridors where it's a straight line between two protected areas, for example, but the matrix, the non-protected areas, that sort of the land that's used for different purposes, you know, not just setting it aside for timber sales, for example, but actually managing the matrix for protection of biodiversity as well as using just the protected areas.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what this bill intends to do is prescribes. It's not merely a bill that designates wilderness on roadless areas, but it provides direction and, in fact, management prescriptions for corridors and for other areas and doing exactly that. And then asks the agencies, because Congress cannot require private individuals to do certain things with private land, and asks, though, that there be a cooperative approach taken to try to come up with some solutions on these private lands. And it deals with the landscape that is not what we would call wild in that sense. Areas that have been affected by some kind of development, but trying to bring that into this larger rubric of ecosystem approach, a bioregional approach, to look at this larger landscape and recognize what changes may occur and how to deal with it.
And I think we have a real opportunity to do that. There's a big shift going on in the West right now with who owns land, who owns ranches. A lot of private land is being turned over to people who have more of a mind for conservation than they have had in the past. And it's particularly apparent around Yellowstone National Park, for example, where many of the ranches and ranchettes that were in the past used for cattle ranching, for example, well, now people are purchasing those lands and don't have any cattle. And so the Park Service has a real opportunity to work with those people to implement management approaches that are more directed towards conservation than they have in the past.
Yeah, exactly. For example, some wolf-friendly ranches.
Absolutely.
And one of the biggest sheep ranches in the state of Idaho is wolf-friendly. Never would have thought even a couple years ago.
And I think, we talk about that, but there's also the opportunity Brian mentioned, which I think is even more important than the wolf-friendly, because I'm not sure that livestock can be that friendly to wolves. It's people that aren't grazing livestock. There are things that are changing in the landscape. They bought a ranch and they don't intend to run cows. And I think that some of those changes may be very positive if people can work within that construct. So that will give bison, for example, a larger, if we're talking about Yellowstone, a larger place to roam, or the wolves, a larger place to roam without getting into trouble. So
we're going to take a musical break. And we'll be back with more Wild Clearwater Country.
Turning, we are real.
Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. We're here with Brian Peterson, and we're moving into our segment of the show called The Peak of the Week.
And this peak is a very common one for people that live near it.
That's right.
As we do here. Very well known, but it's, well, I say common in the sense it's well known. I didn't mean common that's not unique, because this peak is quite unique on this mountain, and it's the little range it's part of. Some rather unique species are found here. It's one of the few places in the Clearwater Country you're going to find on, in and around it, around this peak. Not, you find a few stands, places of western hemlock here in the Palouse Ranger District, so I give that much of a clue. But surprisingly, there is no more public land up owned by all citizens of the U.S. on this peak that's owned by all citizens. So it's, although it's within what we call the external boundary of the Palouse Ranger District of the Clearwater National Forest, actually it's of the St. Joe Forest, managed by the Clearwater. That makes things very confusing. It's an area that was well loved. It's very unique. It's got, as I said, some of the species. It's got elements of both prairie on its lower slopes and forests, the inland northwest forests, the wetter components. And in fact, it's got one of the, something that's very, very unique. Right near the apex of this peak, there's a large cedar grove. And it's one of the higher elevation, if not the highest elevation, cedar groves that I can think of here in the Clearwater Country. And there may be some, there are some other ones that are fairly high, but I don't know any that are equal to this in height.
Hmm.
There might be one up near Wheatus Creek on, I believe it's off of Wheatus Butte, but I'm not sure that even that grove is as high as this one. And the other thing that's unique about it, rather than being what they call the western hemlock slash red cedar type, this is different. This is more of a western red cedar tamarack or larch type, western larch type. Again, very, very unique since it's in this interface of these wetter forests, and it's got elements of a lot of different things isolated, stuck out here. And in fact, it's named after the town here, so you all know it, Moscow Mountain.
All right.
Moscow Mountain, just give a little bit of information here, is just a tad under 5,000 feet in elevation, according to the Clearwater National Forest map. It lists the summit as 4,983 feet.
Man, we need an earthquake. We got to break that.
We got to get just 5, a little higher. Got to get over 5,000 feet, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, it's like when you're, you know, 12 or 13 years old, you really want to be over 5 feet tall.
Exactly.
Ah, man.
Exactly. And so we just need to get over that big 5,000 there with a little bit of an earthquake. Maybe, and then maybe if we do remeasure it, maybe it will be. Well, one never knows. But Moscow Mountain, again, a very diverse spot. Of course, a lot of logging is taking place because there's a lot of private land, so there's loss of a lot of integrity. But again, there have been reports we've heard. Unconfirmed. Well, I don't know if they're unconfirmed. There have been reports of wolves ranging as far west as Moscow Mountain,
mm-hmm.
from, of course, the packs in and around Beauville. There's apparently some pack activity here in the Clearwater, in this part of the Palouse Ranger District on the Clearwater National Forest and an associated private and state land there. There's some state land, of course, a state experimental forest. There's on the backside of Moscow Mountain. And it is truly, it is a peak that is within the Clearwater watershed. The southeast part of the mountain and the peak itself drain, the southeast part drain into the Clearwater River. And they actually go into the Potlatch and into the Clearwater through such streams as Little Bear Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have Meadow Creek, which is Troy's water supply coming off of Moscow Mountain there, that very eastern side of it. And the north side, the Palouse River drainage, and the west is all in the Palouse River. So There we have it.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing wildlife close to home.
Close to home.
Thriving moose population on Moscow Mountain, which has been studied for a few years
Bobcats,
now.
Bobcats, black bear, of course.
Lynx reported.
There have been reports of lynx, amazingly.
Elk, whitetail and mule deer.
Whitetail, and you've seen some muleys up there. I haven't seen muleys.
Well, I know of a very reliable source who watches them out his front window quite often.
Yes. Oh, yeah, they're right. There are muleys up there. I just haven't seen them up there.
Precipitation averages about 27 inches a year from Moscow Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that falling is rain and snow during the fall, winter, and spring. Hopefully mm-hmm. we'll get some more of that in snow here mm-hmm. in the near future. And as Gary mentioned, quite a diversity in conifer species, including western hemlock, and those giant western red cedars. If you haven't visited the cedars up there, it's a remarkable place, especially to visit in the snow and snowshoes. Grand fir and Doug fir, by far the most common tree species, but also ponderosa pines, western larch, quite a few western larch, western white pines, lodgepole pines, and Engelmann spruce.
Yeah, there we go.
Moscow Mountain. Our peak of the week.
Okay.
All right. Well, got a few more minutes left of the show here. I think we can probably spend the rest of the time talking about this week's Whopper of the Week, Brian. So I think we'll go ahead on into that. Time for the Whopper of the Week. And this week's Whopper, kind of some disappointing news. Not unexpected, but disappointing news. We all know that Dirk Kempthorne now resides as the Secretary of the Interior, which means that he is the boss of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been cooperating with the state of Wyoming and now says that they are ready to lift protection for wolves not only there when they're after their agreement has been accepted, because it hasn't been accepted yet, but they're ready to lift protection starting next month in the state of Idaho and Montana. Pretty disappointing, but not completely surprising. I'll read a little bit from the blurb here. The head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said Tuesday his agency will start removing federal protections for gray wolves in Montana and Idaho by January, regardless of whether Wyoming has submitted an acceptable plan to manage its own wolves by then. The reason they have that bit at the end about Wyoming is because these wolves are not supposed to be delisted until all three states have acceptable plans to manage them. So they're breaking their promises there. Wyoming's plan is tied up in lawsuits, and Fish and Wildlife Director Dave Hall said his agency is moving ahead with Idaho and Montana, where management plans are already in place. Defenders of Wildlife and other groups, including Friends of the Clearwater, do maintain that delisting by state is illegal. To continue, wolves were reintroduced to the Northern Rockies in a decade ago after being hunted to near extinction and now number more than 1,200 in the region. With the rising population, state officials, including Governor Jim Risch and Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, have been pushing Fish and Wildlife to remove Endangered Species Act protection that the officials say hamper control efforts aimed at stopping the predators from eating livestock, as well as elk that are prized by hunters. It's amazing, after all the press that have come out in the denial of this proposal to kill wolves in the Clearwater by Fish and Wildlife, that folks are still using the elk as an argument for delisting wolves.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable, actually.
It is. General consensus is that habitat has had the major impact on elk herd supposed decline in the region, succession of shrubs and grasslands into forests, and especially in the Clearwater region. Southern Idaho is a bit different. We also have part of a whopper to give to Governor Jim Risch for this statement, that the wolves, they will be managed just as cats and black bears are managed, Risch said following a meeting in Boise on Tuesday. Certainly, there will be a reduction from what there is right now. Because the explosion in numbers, they've got to be controlled. So kind of this scare tactic mentality, and the fact that the state would like to manage their wolves as the cats and black bears are managed is a pretty scary proposal. Cats and black bears don't receive much respect in the state of Idaho. In fact, there's a lot of information out right now about the human exploitation of mountain lions across the American West. Puma Conservation org as well as the Mountain Lion Foundation have just released a report detailing the increased slaughter of mountain lions throughout the West in the last century, and the results are pretty astounding. And I think this stems simply from the same reasons that we extirpated these species early in the 1900s, is it's fear.
Yeah, definitely.
So the Whopper of the Week goes to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah, it's too bad. I just read recently that the gray wolves, while they've had a nice comeback and have a fairly strong population now, they still only inhabit about 5% of their historic range. And so it really gets at the question what recovery is. And the bottom line is that these Western states typically don't really care about what scientific recovery means. They just want to get rid of what they perceive as pests, which, you know, it's their prerogative, but the reality is the Endangered Species Act is predicated upon sound science. And so we really should be making these decisions not on political whims, but on ecological grounds, basically.
That's a great point, Brian, and I'm sure the same can be said for, well, mountain lions probably inhabit more of the range than many of the large carnivores that have been pushed away, like the brown bear.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see the brown bear on the state of California's flag, because not any brown bears, I don't think, are found within the state there now.
Not for a long, long time, sadly.
Yeah, wolves are going to face a test here in the next 12 months, and there are quite a few groups cooperating, organizing to continue to dispel some of the myths, which is a difficult task for educators because a lot of the folks would rather not be educated and hold dear to the fact that these wolves do threaten their livelihood. You're not going to change those folks' opinions easily, if at all. And in fact, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, which is a national organization, they have chapters in all the Western states. They're holding a rally January 11th in Boise to promote delisting of the species, and they have a petition going right now. So if you are in Boise, if you hear this on streaming audio, or if you're going to be in the Boise area January 11th, we need some folks out there to say, no, this is baloney. These wolves should not be delisted until we have proof that they have recovered and met management objectives, and before we have a reasonable conservation-based management plan in place to take care of this population, which should be managed, I think, by the Nez Perce tribe, which did most of the work getting them here.
Right. It's been a long, long haul to get this recovery effort going, and it'd be a real shame to delist the species now before we really know where it's headed. And I just want to say, you know, this is a great opportunity for people who are interested in this issue to do something about it, write a letter to the editor, do something to raise the awareness on this issue, because sadly, most people are uneducated about the issue, don't really know all the facts, and, you know, that unfortunately serves the interests of people who want delisting to happen.
That's true. And if you want more information about wolves, specifically wolves in north central Idaho, check out friendsoftheclearwater.org. Do a search for wolves. There's plenty of information there. And write down January 11th. It'd be great to get a huge group of folks down there who would like to see our natural heritage protected, which includes the top-level predators. And we still don't know how important those top-level predators are in many ecosystems, but they do have a great impact in regulating ecological systems, and that's an important job, and not one that should be discarded because of unproven fear.
And you know, that's interesting you bring that up, actually. But one of the things I read recently was that protecting top predators disproportionately impacts other species. So basically what that's saying is that when you protect a top predator like that, you have all these other conservation benefits throughout the system, other species that are protected. And one of the interesting things about wolves in particular is that because they kill large animals and then they leave the carrion there, that impacts all kinds of other species. And so it really is important to protect wolves, not only for their own sake, but also for the system as a whole, basically. They're incredibly important.
Yeah, bringing it all back, and another reason to support NARIPA. Protection of big chunks of land has so many indirect benefits and direct benefits. It's really, I think, the model for conservation. And fortunately, in the West, we have an opportunity to continue to look at the ecosystems in that manner. We have some big chunks that are still relatively intact. I agree. Top-level predator protection really can have some cascading effects on everything from ungulates on down.
That's right. And, you know, one of the issues that we haven't talked about today but is important in all this is roadless area protection, because a lot of these species are impacted by habitat fragmentation. You know, with climate change coming, we're going to need to have as much intact habitat as possible. And so not only do we need to protect the wolves, we need to make sure we protect these last remaining roadless areas as well. And so it's these same issues we keep talking about all the time, but they're so critical for the long-term viability of Western systems as we know them.
Bingo. Brian, good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
This is all from the Wild Clearwater Country this week.